Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Oh, thank you, Brian. That was, of course, Brian Brown, who is the creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Brown Briefly and brought his high standards of hosting what we think is a very intelligent discussion of current events. Of course, always laced with humor and empathy. And we are striving to our best to match that standard that he brought. His mantra, of course, was less is more, more or less. And of course, he always offered more. This is the Brown Briefly. And today we're calling it the Truman Show because we don't have a guest today. So they always throw it to me when we have that situation. So I better introduce the Brieflies here to get started. Zooming in from his home here on Vachon above Burton is the voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group. Our tireless defender of democracy who strives to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
Good morning, Truman. I'm doing well and glad to be here with the Brieflies.
Thanks. And, of course, also zooming in from his home up above KVI Beach is a historian extraordinaire, skipper of the Vachona, president of Vachon's own fantastic, amazing Heritage Museum. Now this introduction says a party animal, and I think that was because he threw quite a party for his birthday.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, there was it was quite a party. I've been to a few parties with Bruce,
he's been
on the tabletops.
I hope he left his clothes on for crying out loud. Gee whiz. But of course he is our own globetrotting guardian of the galaxy, Mr. Bruce Halsman. Hey Bruce, how are you?
Hey, good to be here this morning.
Good.
Cold and crisp morning.
It is foggy. It was foggy up down at KVI this morning?
Oh, yeah. I drove up to town we'll talk about it in a bit, but I drove up to town about, 8:30 or something like that. It was foggy all the way up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Slick patches out there.
Indeed. My pickup had frost on the windshield, and it said it was 31 degrees out, so I'm sure there was a bit of advice there. Of course, sitting next to me here at the Gene Bosch broadcast studio, it's former tow truck repo man, Pinkerton guard of the Pan Am's first 747 at San Francisco, high fashion women's shoe salesman, which I adore, former Washington State assistant attorney general, tort and constitutional law professor, two-time Fulbright scholar, and international arbitrator and mediator, Craig Billis.
Hey, Craig. How you doing, folks? It's a pleasure to be here once again with the Brieflies.
Yes.
I look forward to a wide-ranging discussion.
Yeah, well, it's probably going to be that. I'm engineering here behind the big board at Vachon Gene Bosch Broadcast Studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon. I'm an airport commissioner and a VOV board member. And
You were Park District.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. Vachon Park District Commissioner as well. Okay, so let's check in with folks. Bruce, what have you been up to this week?
Oh, gosh, it's been a kind of crazy week with Thanksgiving, with the Seahawks being embarrassed.
Oh, boy.
And the Huskies barely pulling it out against WSU.
Oh, no kidding.
No darns.
Yeah, Friday should be a fairly interesting game. UW-Oregon, that Friday evening, it'll be a really fascinating game. But it's also been an interesting week in terms of today is Giving Tuesday, which means it's a day for nonprofits to reach out for support. So Voice of Vachon, of course, give to Voice of Vachon, give to the Heritage Museum. And I have a claim to fame with Vachon Reads, which is a mobile sort of library bookmobile that goes around Vachon. It's converted little Japanese truck that's been converted to a bookmobile, a former fire truck that's been converted to a bookmobile. Well, if you get their email, my claim to fame is that my daughter-in-law and grandson are in the photograph using the bookmobile. So Theodore is sitting in the back of the van looking through books, and his mom, Shelby, standing out there looking beautiful as always. So it's sort of a claim to fame, if you will. But it is Giving Tuesday. So reach out to all those nonprofits. Nonprofits depend on all of those donations. I mean, it's great when you can give big bucks to a nonprofit, but, you know, those $25, $50, and $100 donations is what makes the nonprofits on Vashon sort of thrive. And last time I looked, there are about 248 listed nonprofits that have addresses on Vashon.
Wow.
248.
Yeah.
Wow. I knew it was over 100, but I had no idea it was that big. Wow.
I think that's the number.
Yeah, wow.
So, we have one. Treetop Flyers.
Yeah. Yeah, right. We wish we did.
Yeah. The Truman Charity, right?
Yeah. The GoFundMe program.
It's not a nonprofit, but it is a nonprofit.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That's right. That's for sure. Intentional or not. Right?
Exactly. Kevin, how about you? What's been going on with you?
Oh, well, like Bruce, I've been, you know, looking back with thanks over the last year of sort of opportunities to enjoy living here in a spectacular part of the country and being able to get out and enjoy it, but also looking ahead. The legislative session is going to be starting up here in a few weeks. So our bill tracking teams are getting geared up and looking at the progressive improvements we can make in our governance. Also, of course, the election season. So Indivisible Vashon, we are taking a look at those really competitive races where your volunteer time can make a big difference. So our Get Out the Vote page, we're dusting that off and hope to have that up and running here in another month or so. But also nearer to home is the on the 21st of December, the Vashon Maury Community Council, speaking of environment, supporting our Vashon Maury environment and climate agenda at their 7 p.m. meeting on Thursday, the 21st of December. So using the sort of quiet time around Thanksgiving to look forward to make sure we have all those events teed up.
All right. So, Craig, how about you?
Yeah, I don't think it'll surprise any of you that Thanksgiving took up a good part of last week, as well as football. We were invited to friends of ours, Steve Holtz and Anna, and had a fabulous meal at their place. Steve is a trained chef, so, boy, he can put together a Thanksgiving dinner. It was marvelous. We had a great time. We also did something, I think it was on Friday or Saturday. My wife and I just took a slow drive around the island, something we haven't done for a while. Went from north to south and visited some of the places that we hadn't been for a while. Places that we were friends are no longer living, used to live, and places where we used to live out on the Burton Peninsula, and it was a beautiful, glorious day, and it was really a wonderful, wonderful trip around. The other thing is, I wanted to send my condolences to my friends in Ohio for the Buckeye loss to the University of Michigan, which was an extraordinarily close game that could have gone either way in the last couple of seconds, but. Such is life.
Boy, how about that? The Huskies though, kicking that field goal. Oh, man, that was something, huh? Gee whiz.
Craig, can I ask you? So, did you get out one of your classic cars for this?
I drove the old BMW 2002 around. Nice. It was a really the perfect car on a perfect, beautiful day.
Yeah, no kidding. So, well, I got out of town for Thanksgiving. You know, years ago, we used to go to La Push. Several families would go out to La Push. And very often there were just incredible storms over Thanksgiving. And the big logs would be crashing on the beach. And I mean, it was just spectacular. But we haven't gone anywhere in a long time over Thanksgiving. So this year we decided we were going to try and go out to Claylock. But of course, I did not move quickly enough. And so there were no openings there. But instead, we went to the Salish Lodge out at Snoqualmie Falls. What a wonderful place. about, gosh, it must have been 40 years ago. My wife and I went there. I think it was our anniversary that we snuck off and went there for one night. But this time we went for a couple of nights. Molly, my daughter, went along, had some fabulous meals. Had to go get a second mortgage on the house to pay for everything. But wow, was it fantastic.
Did you have that giant brunch?
We had just the regular brunch, but where they
poured... Which is giant enough. Yes.
Yeah, where they poured
the honey.
The honey, yeah. You know, somebody told me something interesting about that yesterday. Oh, I know who it was. It was Jeff Sayer. Said that when he was a young assistant, an attorney joins a firm? No.
An associate.
An associate, that's the word I was looking for. The Salish Lodge sued another organization, another company, for stealing that event where they pour the honey. And they were trying to either trademark it or patent it or something. They lost. But isn't that interesting?
It is. There are all sorts of interesting cases in the trademark, copyright, patent area that kind of blow your mind, actually.
I couldn't believe it. Kevin.
I would wonder if, you know, at the market where you see them throwing the fish, right? The
fishermen.
I wonder, you know, maybe that falls in that same category.
It might very well. You know, it's funny, Truman, the very first time I went to Salish, or Snoqualmie Falls Lodge at the time, years ago, we went to brunch.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at my plate, you know, and I'm talking to my wife, and all of a sudden I see this out of the corner of my eye coming down over my shoulder. And I don't know what it is. And I put my hand out.
Oh, no. Was the honey?
It was the honey.
No. Did you catch it?
No, I got my hand out of the way just in time.
Oh, God. Nice. That would have been nice.
Yeah, good thing honey flows slowly.
Yeah. Well, the other thing we did, I was not Johnny on the spot here, so I missed getting the Thanksgiving dinner reservation at the lodge. So instead, I found reservations out at the Snoqualmie Casino. Well, we went out early to watch the football game, and which was, of course, like Bruce said, a total embarrassment. We're sitting in the bar watching this thing going, what are we doing? I mean, all the noise of the casino and the smoke. And anyway, the only redeeming thing there was that the dinner was amazing. They have the Vista Room there is quite elegant, actually, and absolutely wonderful for food. But
casinos are typically not the quietest, mellowest places in the world.
No.
I've spent a little time in casinos, but not for a quiet time.
No. It's quite very noisy and very, not exactly my cup of tea. But
do you do any gambling?
Oh, yeah. I lost about $20, you know. That's all.
Doing what were you doing?
Well, just playing the stupid machines.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I didn't do any of the other stuff. I'm not into that. I'm going to go with you sometime.
I'm going to take you up there, and I'm going to teach you how to play craps, right?
Yeah, I want to do that. I really do. That's going to be fun. Okay, hey, today is the 28th. It's National French Toast Day for all of you folks. Speaking of breakfast... And here's something I found really interesting. November 24th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 28th have the lowest number of birthdays in the U.S., those dates. Now, February is actually the month with the lowest birthdays, the fewest number of birthdays. But those dates, 24th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, are the lowest days. Isn't that interesting?
What is 9 months before that?
I don't know. I hadn't figured that out.
Trying to count out, you know.
Yeah, but isn't that interesting?
Is that tax day or something?
Yeah, it could be. It could be something very depressing, no doubt. But
I think it might be a February influence as well, actually.
Yeah, it could be. Could be. Anyway, I found that interesting. Interesting.
It is 9 months before those dates that you just said when the month ends. You know, short month in February. So.
Okay, well, maybe there it is. That could be it. Well, you'd think in cold and dark and, you know, nothing else to do, but, well, anyway. So today in history, 1720, here's, I got some all women things here today. In 1720, Anne Bonny and Mary Read were tried and found guilty of pirating and sentenced to death in the Spanish town, Jamaica. However, their sentences were the stays of execution were made because they were found to be pregnant, both of them. Isn't that interesting? Had no idea. And in 1893...
I've used that defense, but it didn't work.
It didn't work.
There were guys.
Yeah, there were guys? Yeah, it didn't work. No. And in 1893, women were allowed to vote in a national election for the very first time in New Zealand. How about
great.
That? 1893.
It's progressive New Zealanders.
Yeah. And in 1919, American-born Lady Nancy Astor was elected as the first female member of the British House of Commons. How about that? You learn all kinds of stuff here.
Can you remember it, though, is the question?
No, of course not. Of course not. But, you know, it's just a bit of trivia. So when you play that game, trivia, you might have that stuck back there in your brain somewhere.
I know.
So there you go. All right, so since we don't have any guests today, we just try and stir up as much as we can from from what's going on in the world around us. Let's start with Trump appearing in court. And my question for everyone is, when is the judge finally going to toss him in jail for all of the nonsense that he's violating the gag order? And what would be the consequence? Anybody have an opinion?
I'm sure we all have opinions. Kevin, you look like you're about ready to launch.
We're all waiting for the attorney.
Oh. The legal opinion.
Oh, well, it's not so much a legal opinion as it is a cost-benefit analysis. The judges are confronted with a real issue of maintaining the integrity of the judicial system and the trials. But at the same time, they're dealing with a very unique defendant, not unique in a good way, but unique. I think they're well aware that somebody who is probably going to be the Republican nominee, unless something radical happens in between, like he gets put in jail or whatever, they have to be careful. So whereas they might give a common everyday defendant one or two strikes, or they're willing to give Trump four strikes, they're being very careful. And they also, I think, recognize that, you know, they're not insulated from the world around them. They know that if they put him in jail for a while, he's liable to stir up even more trouble and support. So there's a lot of balancing going on. But I think he's bound for more serious consequences, because he will continue to push. He's playing a cost-benefit analysis. He doesn't care if it costs him $100,000, $203,000, million dollars. He's going to make more money in contributions and in votes, I think, in his calculation. Hmm. So,
yeah, Kevin.
I am curious, Craig, when you refer to a cost-benefit analysis, it sort of implies, I'm an engineer, so I got to be careful here, implies that we're assigning a cost to the value of hearing what the former president says. I'm curious if you assign a positive or a negative cost.
Yeah, well, you could probably guess where my head's at on that one. But.
Yeah.
I just had to ask. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I find disturbing about all of this is that the people in the judicial system are receiving threats every day. I mean, they're like, they get like 30 calls a day or emails a day threatening, you know, violence against them, their families, their, you know, everyone. What in the world? I mean, how do we deal with that? You know, I mean, I assume they're pursuing those people that are threatening, but Kevin?
Yeah, I, the other thought that came to mind, and I'm curious to see what Bruce may have to enlighten us on this notion of what, in my mind, what we're seeing is the value of the legal system and its, or need to uphold its, dignity, if you will, against the ability for free speech and the competition between those things. And I don't know historically if, you know, there have been past situations where this arm wrestling competition competition has taken place. In my opinion, you know, legal system is pretty much the foundation of how the country runs. And associated with that is objective truth upon which you can base legal decisions. And all of those things have, of course, been challenged by the previous administration. But in this case, I'd be curious to me historically to see how this works out with the balance between the legal system and the person's right to say whatever they want.
Yeah, if I can jump in, and Craig maybe can help me with this as well. I mean, Kevin, it seems to me you're coming from a sort of a post-World War II liberal, you know, sort of small L liberal kind of attitude about the courts in America. The courts have not always been this paragon of virtue in American politics. And, you know, and there have been threats against justices and courts, you know, all through American history. I mean, it's not unusual. You don't read about it much, but, you know, the Haymarket trials, I mean, there were lots of threats against, you know, from radical anarchists and labor movement at the time when they were being vilified. I mean, the thing I have to remind myself all the time is that in 1896, the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson declares that separate but equal is constitutional. You know, in 1953, what about, what, 56 years later, it totally reverses itself, Brown versus Board of Education. And that's the nature, to me, of the American judicial system and political system. I mean, this concept of judges being sort of above the above the fray of politics, it's never been that way. But in that sort of post-World War II period, and particularly in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, I think a lot of folks sort of idealized the American democratic system and idealized the judicial's role in that system. And yet in the Constitution, it's just one of three balanced powers. And so it's always been sort of at the whim of public opinion. It may move more slowly than the legislature or the executive, but the courts are not insulated. Craig, what's your take on that?
Well, I agree 100% that we elect and we appoint judges, not just to look at a set of facts and look up the law and say, oh, well, this is the way it is, because it's never that simple. The little variations in the facts can make a tremendous difference in the outcome of a case. Judges are there to judge, and they're going to apply their own moral and ethical, you know, mores to a case. They're going to try not to let it influence. They're going to try to decide the case based on the facts and the law, but there's so much room for interpretation. So that's why you have to be careful as to who you vote for judge or who you vote for who can appoint judges because of that room. If it was otherwise, you know, we'd leave it up to AI. And they can decide every case. I would suggest that's not a good idea either. The other thing is that you were talking about the role of the courts, Bruce, is the courts have only fairly recently in the last, 50, 60 years, decided that everything can be decided by the courts. They used to have a much more hands-off position where they thought, no, this isn't for the courts to decide. This is for the legislature, for people to decide on their own. We're not going to get involved in every single case. It's like the community council. You can't get involved in every single case. You know, you don't have the, it's not part of your mission and but not part of the you know, you can't handle the administration of those things. So,
well, is this a function of our litigious society, or is this, I mean, the fact that you can get sued for spitting on the sidewalk, for crying out loud? I mean, is that,
you could always get sued for spitting on the sidewalk.
I know you could, but don't you think that this is a factor of the fact that we're doing so much more of that now?
Well, pushing. I mean, we keep pushing. We keep bringing cases to the court because they're not being resolved anywhere else.
Right.
And they're thinking maybe at the courts, well, at least we'll get a relatively fair shake.
If I can jump in, too, and in part, one of the things that comes about it is it depends on how authoritarian your mind is in terms of how you view the courts. You know, I mean, if you're a real rule follower, and if you're, you know, the straight and narrow kind of thing, then you look to the courts for very specific straight and narrow kind of decisions. If you come from it from the perspective, I think many of us come from, that it's very nuanced, it's very complicated, there are no simple kind of answers, then the courts become this sort of a battleground of ideas. And like Craig said, I mean, they're there to judge. They're not there to make absolute decisions based on certainties, because there are no certainties in those terms. Is that the way you see it, Craig?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like we were talking about last week or the week before, the cognitive behavioral process looks for certainty, looks for pigeonholes, looks for simplicity. Mm-hmm. And we'd think, like every one of my law students, almost every one of my law students, when they came to law school on the first day, they would say, just tell me what the law is. I'll memorize it, and that's all I need to know. And I go, uh-uh. I have to dissuade you of that right away. That is not the way it works. Wow. So there are just too many differences, just slight differences that can make the difference in who's liable, who's guilty, that sort of thing.
Yeah, Kevin.
You know, kind of along those lines, but maybe I had this opportunity to meet with one of the state Supreme Court justices. A friend had a relationship, and there was a group of us visiting Olympia, and so we had a chance to meet and talk about the work they were doing. And they talked about their role relative to legislation, and that when legislation is passed, it may or may not be in compliance with the Constitution or with accepted law. It can pass the legislature regardless of that. And then somebody would have to come along, at least this is my interpretation of what they were conveying to us. Someone would have to come along and say, hey, somebody acting in alignment with that legislation, I disagree with what they did, and I'm going to take you to court. And at that point, you know, the courts would weigh in and say, yeah, that law is inappropriate. And so I asked, you know, do you engage with the lawmakers ahead of time? And it's like, well, no, we don't really do that. It's sort of like the legislative process should be able to navigate its own course and not be burdened by anybody's interpretation of the law. Obviously, they would avoid major, grievances. But I found it fairly fascinating about how this description of the relationship between the legislative branch and the judicial branch here in Washington State, according to this one justice.
Well, I think you nailed it in terms of that relationship. The laws are oftentimes drafted by assistant attorney generals. The hope is that they're following the Constitution when they do it. And more often than not, they are. But the referendum process is the one that really tests the constitutionality. As we know, Mr. Iman has run afoul of that on several occasions, the whole tab tax.
$30 tab.
The community council and the transit workers were able to get overturned as being unconstitutional. Our community council, Vashon's community council, years ago. That was... That showed that the exact relationship between the creation of laws and then checking them out for their constitutionality.
Yeah, and it's intriguing to me that we can exist in this space where there's a law or a referendum been passed which is not compliant with the Constitution or not, you know, wouldn't be supported by the Constitution. Nonetheless, in the intervening time, you know, presumably we're acting on that approved piece of legislation or that approved referendum. And so this notion that, yeah, here's the law, here's what it is, and let's go just implement it. In cases like that, certainly, it calls into question that this is a very fluid thing, right, that is interpreted on a daily basis, depending on the circumstances.
Yeah, Bruce.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, you know, and Craig, you mentioned the referendum. the referendum initiative, the direct election of senators. Those are all progressive reforms that come in at the very beginning of the 20th century. And they come in because American governmental democracy was not as representative as people wanted it to be. And so it sort of opened up that legislative process, if you will, to individuals who can say, wait a minute, I want a law that does this. And you know, if you get enough votes, then it gets on the books. And then if it gets on the books, then it jumps into the judicial system, which has to rule on constitutionality and all those kind of things. You know, I think we're in the midst of another kind of progressive revolution in America right now. And the battle lines are really clear. Between sort of the MAGA Republicans on the one side, you know, sort of the quote unquote liberals on the other side, and the great undecided middle. It'll be fascinating, particularly in the next 2024 election and the next couple of elections after that, whether or not we'll see a new wave of sort of progressive reforms that begins to address those limitations of what the American democracy has evolved into. Certainly by the end of the 19th century, people were very dissatisfied with the voice of the public in making laws. And so that's why you get the initiative and the referendum. That's why you get a direct election of senators, moving away from state legislators electing senators to the public. Voters electing senators. And so it'll be, to me, it's going to be fascinating because I see so many parallels from the late 19th century, sort of the Gilded Age, the robber barons, you know, incredible wealth disparities in America that resulted in a progressive movement that transformed American politics. You know, and we're in the same situation, in a very similar, and it's never the same, but we're in a similar situation. And whether it's going to veer toward the reforms, progressive reforms that sort of redefine American democracy, or whether it's going to veer toward authoritarian solutions. That's the crux of where we are right now, to me.
So it seems like what makes, I mean, I don't know if, I think it was you, Kevin, that said, or maybe it was you, Craig, that said, you know, we really want things to be black and white. We want it to be, this is the way it is, you know. And I think that's one of the things that brings on the support for this authoritarian rule, because you want somebody to say, no, this is the way it is. It's this way. It's not. And, you know, this kind of enlightens me right now, in fact, to why that is more of an ongoing thing that's occurring right now in our.
Without rocking the boat too badly, that's also one of the reasons why certain religions are very popular.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell sure. you how to act, how to yeah. respond.
It's actually, you know, black and white. Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
I was thinking, Truman, on what you just said, that, you know, certain things we'd like to be black and white. Well, I think a lot of law we do want to be black and white, right? Mm-hmm. If you exceed the speed limit, you are putting yourself at risk of getting a speeding ticket, a violation, right? Moving violation.
Right.
So a lot of the law, I think it's like, okay, let's be really clear that we want to govern ourselves using mm-hmm. these processes, and let's be real clear where the lines are. Fortunately, the majority of people, maybe not the majority of drivers, but probably a large number of drivers, you know, recognize and abide by that. But there's certainly a number of cases we're seeing now as the judicial system is being pressed, right, where there's a lot of gray area out there, depending on what exactly, you know, question comes up.
I was going to say,
my perspective, I guess.
No, you're right. But if, you know, the way this all gets intertwined, if the law is not specific and black and white enough, it can be challenged as unconstitutional, as being vague. I actually want a parking ticket based on a constitutional argument here on the on the island many years ago about the arbitrary and capricious enforcement of parking at the North End parking lot.
Really?
Yeah. Cool. And the judge threw it out and said, yeah, you let them park, you know, out of the way so that they don't block the traffic outside the designated parking areas. I didn't, you know, didn't mean to be a scofflaw, but but occasionally, you know, that would happen. I'd park there, somebody else would park like that, and they didn't block traffic. And And I went into the court, and the court said, "Yeah, you're right. That was done improperly." And I thought I didn't have a snowball's chance of winning that case in a traffic court, but I did.
But you did, yeah. So let's get back to this black and white and traffic. I mean, this is so. If we're talking about the referendum and initiatives, so let's say that a number of people on the island says, you know, I really don't like this 40-mile-an-hour speed limit that we've got here. It really ought to be 55. So they get together a bunch of signatures and, you know, 1,000 people or whatever number says, yeah, we agree that should be. And we take it to the court or to the legislature, I guess, or where would we go? I guess to the county. Anyway, is that the way the referendums work? Is that the way they should work?
That would be an uphill battle. Because you have to go through several layers in order to, because I think the state has adopted the National Transportation Code and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So you'd probably have to have it changed.
But my point is that, I mean, is that the process? Is that the referendum process?
It's the beginning of it. Yeah.
As we see it. Yeah.
Well, and I'm curious, as you mentioned that, we know that the initiative process, right? Gather enough signatures, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. deliver those in Olympia. And there's a few different paths, but basically some initiative is either dealt with by the legislature or ends up being put on the ballot for the voters. I don't know if the county has a similar process for, you know, trying to modify county regulations. That's just an area of ignorance for me.
Yeah.
But certainly at the state, yeah, that's a well-known path.
Right. Well, this kind of is a good segue into the next question, which is the Colorado judge has offered an opinion that Trump did incite an insurrection, but he can still appear on the ballot. And the appeal of this court, of this decision, that Trump's lawyers reiterated that the wording of the Section 3 does not apply to people running for president, and that Trump technically did not swear an oath to, quote, support the Constitution. Instead, during the 2017 inauguration, Trump swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, but not to support it. I find this absolutely incredulous. I mean, what do you think?
Well, right? If the law says that, the law is a ass, to quote Dickens, I think. I know. That's exactly what the court said. They made an extraordinarily strict interpretation of the Constitution. As we say, they sliced the salami about as thin as it can be sliced to reach that result. Certainly the intent of the law would apply in, you know, 10 times to the president, rather, you know, as opposed to lower office holders. But that was the finesse that the court engaged in, and it has a credible basis. It just seems almost unbelievable. But and of course, the other part of the opinion that said that he did incite, it doesn't carry presidential value anywhere except for in Colorado, or doesn't carry presidential value at all. It's a lower court decision.
Decision, yeah. Kevin?
Yeah, you know, when I heard this, and Craig, this is an area I'm really curious what you think about, what went through my head. It seemed, you know, ludicrous, right, that this sort of technicality in the verbiage would lead to this outcome. And then I'm thinking about this judge who's in this interesting historical place to be able to basically remove somebody from a ballot, particularly a former president, and maybe feeling like maybe I'm not the one, you know, to put myself out there to do that. So is it like, yeah, you know, the guy incited a resurrection and incited an insurrection.
There you go.
Sort of logically, that would tell you that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment means take them off the ballot. But I want somebody else to put their, you know,
yeah, their stamp
their,
on that
reputation on the line. So I'll come up with this really sort of convoluted rationale for that. So it's definitely going to get appealed and let somebody else sort it out. and I have no idea if that's a motive. And Craig, like I say, I was thinking of you and that came to mind for me.
It may very well have been. Judges don't like to be reversed. And they hard cases make bad law, as they say. The court has decided that Trump incited not a resurrection, but an insurrection. So now the appellate court, when it deals with that, is they're probably going to be stuck with that finding. And then the issue is going to be solely, do they agree with the constitutional interpretation? They're all very reluctant to knock somebody off the ballot without a finding of inciting a, you know, insurrection, although now they have it. So we'll see.
So what's the process then, Greg? This is going to go to an appellate court and they're going to decide whether or not the Section 3 applies or...
Yeah, yeah. And it'll move up.
And then will it eventually end up at the Supreme Court, we think?
Well, the Supreme Court still doesn't like to deal with certain issues. And there's this exclusion for political issues, political questions.
Yeah.
And even this current somewhat sympathetic court to ex-President Trump may say, nope, but we're not going to touch
gonna hear
this.
No,
too hot to handle. We're going to leave it up to whatever the last decision was below us.
So I'm kind of curious, we hear the argument on this topic of whether or not, that Trump should be allowed on the ballot and the nuance in the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And some of what you're going to hear is let the voters decide. we're voters, we're in a democracy, let the voters decide. And I take that to a couple of different places. One is, the voters get to decide in a case, for example, when they're brought into a jury. And it's a jury of your peers, and those are voters, and presumably, and maybe not all the time, but this notion of judged by your peers is part of our legal system. But the notion that you're going to let voters decide a merit of whether something is constitutional or unconstitutional, and decide that the voters are going to be better qualified to make that call than constitutional legal scholars, in my mind, is totally out of line. And curious what people think about that.
I could not agree more. I think that's ridiculous, if you want to know. How about you, Bruce? The historical perspective.
Depends on how much you believe in democracy. And it's sort of like, hey, if democracy is indeed the expression of the will of the people, then, those kind of things should go to the people. And the problems with democracy is that you have to live with the things that you don't like, and that sort of creates a problem in a society like ours that's becoming incredibly diverse, incredibly multicultural, incredibly divided. And it's sort of, to me, comes down to that very essence of that question. You veer toward democracy and indeed, a government and policy representing the will of the people, whatever that is, or do you veer toward autocracy and sort of individuals and selected individuals or self-selected individuals making those decisions? And it's a tough balance, but, I always come down on the side of democracy. I mean, the whole reason we have a constitution structured the way it is to keep democracy from becoming a pure democracy. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of structured democracy. It's a democracy with limits, with guardrails, the Supreme Court, the Senate, representing, an elite, if you will, a House of Lords almost, and so it really comes down to that question. Craig, what do you think? At a legal point of view.
My opinion on it, I can't cite your case, but is basically the reason why we have the three, parts of our government is because they all play a role. And if we had a pure democracy, the thought there, the way you were defining it for a moment, is you might believe in the people deciding everything and basically excising out some of these other parts of our government from their respective and assigned roles. So the court always has a role in deciding the legality, the constitutionality. Maybe to a different degree, but that's always been limited to them, the judiciary, and we don't want to hand that over totally to the masses.
Yeah. No, and that's really the genius, if you will, of the American political system. It's a structure of balance of powers. It's sort of countervailing powers. You know, the legislature, which theoretically is the voice of the people. You know, the executive branch, which is the president and all that flows from that, and the courts. And it's the contention between those three balancing powers that really has allowed American democracy to emerge as it has. And it's not a pure democracy, but the intention was to have, I think the intention was to have the House of Representatives come close to that pure democracy, balanced by the Senate, you know, which was a much more conservative, slower moving body. And then both of those balanced by the executive branch and by the courts. And that's the genius of the American political system. Whether it can hold through the crisis that we're in right now is really the question.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by this notion that you raised, Bruce. You know, if you believe in democracy, then, you know, the people deciding these issues is consistent with that. But we could take I'm left in this dilemma because we could take another example of, let's put a 14-year-old on the presidential ballot, clearly in violation of the 14th Amendment. But if the people vote that 14-year-old to be our president, then okay, let's go with it. In other words, we believe in the Constitution until we don't. I guess I don't know that that's what you were intending to imply, but that's the thought that came to mind as we were having that conversation. I guess I would prefer an approach that says, let's interpret and apply the Constitution. And if the people decide that they're unhappy with that outcome, let's change the Constitution. Let's not just set it aside when it's inconvenient. I'm curious what other people think about that also.
Well, the thing that strikes me is, I'm thinking about some of the Middle East countries, and we say we're going to introduce democracy to the Middle East country, and then get the people to decide, and then they decide they want an authoritarian person to run this program. You know, it's like, and then we go, whoa, wait a minute. Well, that's what the people decided. You know, that's what they wanted. So what are we going to say about it, you know?
Yeah, in that case, you know, I mean, there is a lot to be said for not having to do the work of democracy, right?
There you go.
Not having to read the voter's guide and not having to fill out that stupid ballot, although how simple it is in Washington State, right? Mm-hmm. Fill in the dots and drop it in the mailbox. Nonetheless, you know, it takes time out of your day. So, an autocracy, what I've heard from others who try to support that kind of a system is your decisions are so much easier. You know, you just do what the government tells you to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've got one more kind of a controversial topic, which I think I may table for a moment because we only have about 10 minutes left here and I can see this going on for a while. But excuse me, I did learn something interesting. And that is that within the state of Washington, we have what's known as the drunkest city in the state of Washington. Any guesses for what city that would be in the state of Washington?
Pullman.
Pullman? I that would be one that I would go for. You're close. You're close, Bruce.
I hesitated, you know, to go online and suss this out, mm-hmm. but I was thinking maybe in the wine country might be.
Oh, well, that's a good place. That's also a good. How about you, Craig? You got any thoughts?
I stayed offline too. Because I really want to be surprised with this one. I thought it might be a university town,
and that's why I said Bruce is close.
Yeah,
Bellingham.
Oh,
Bellingham. The survey said that 22.9% of the adults there stated that they drink excessively in Bellingham. So, how about Oregon? Any ideas about Oregon?
Eugene.
Yeah, no, see, again, staying with that thought.
Corvallis, right?
Yeah, those are what I would think. No, it's Bend.
Bend?
Yeah. Really, Bend?
Bend, huh. Yeah. And I kind of get that idea.
Have a lot of breweries there.
Well, and not only that, but you're kind of out in the sticks, you know, and there's not much else to do. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. All right, last one, Idaho. Any thoughts about Idaho?
It's got to be Moscow.
Well, I thought so too, but it's actually Lewiston.
Lewiston.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there you go. All right, that was my
that was my
trivia for the day.
And so now we have to go. Okay, so we have to go to the next level, right? Here's the data. Now, what are the correlations? Right? Is somebody mentioned a lot of breweries? I thought wine country. So I'm curious.
College town.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably got to be the main reason there.
Yeah.
That and the fact that it's on the west side of the mountains.
Yeah. So my question is, if those are the wettest or drunkest, which are the most sober?
Exactly.
That would be interesting.
That would be interesting to find out. Yeah, I would be curious about that. It's probably not Vashon. But.
And also, you know, the college towns correlation, is that because there's a lot of college students, or that in order to serve the market, there's a lot of establishments where you can go buy a beverage and therefore that brings in the entirety. So maybe it gets complicated.
Yeah.
The conversation.
It may be the fact that there's a lot of college faculty members.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, with the,
who needed it?
Craig, your background, I think you can probably appreciate that. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. All right. So let's the local area here. We've got the school district. Our school board now are all women. Any thoughts about our opinions about that?
I think I'm disqualified because I sit here as a older white male. Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah. No, that's why I brought it up. That's exactly why I brought it up. That's exactly why I brought it up.
Well, I think it's going to be. I think it's great. I don't really, I'm not quick to say that that's going to bring a new approach. Every one of these four individuals were judged on their merits and their individual positions and. People had concerns about one person and another person over these various issues. They tried to resolve them, will they work better together? I don't know. I think they'll work together as well as a well-meaning group of men would. So that's where my head is at on that one.
I mean, there's also that 30% rule concept. You know, that any time any board or any organization becomes 30% more or more of women, it changes the way decisions are made. And that's a fascinating thing to look at. But it's also, to me, it's just a reflection of how far our country has come in sort of bringing people who were previously excluded from positions of power.
That's kind of what I was thinking, too, Bruce.
Power. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a slow process, and but it's just a reflection. You look throughout governmental structures at the number of women who are in place in places of power, and the higher up you go, of course, in the Senate and the House, it's still minuscule, but in state legislatures, in county governments, school districts, library boards, it's just a reflection of the changes in American society. And that goes for also people of color and ethnic minorities being represented. But it's also one of the things that's pressuring, I think, sort of MAGA Republicans in the reactionaryism. It's sort of like, wait a minute, this world is changing too fast. That sort of barefoot, pregnant, behind the plow kind of attitude of the 19th century still lives. And this is a reflection of that change. And it upsets a lot of people.
Yep, I agree. Kevin?
Well, and I am hoping to continue the process of change, Bruce, as you mentioned. We're in a time where, we have an opportunity to experience being categorized in our empathy and our progressive policy positions based on our race and the color of our skin and our gender. And there are historical precedent right? Which leads us easily to draw those conclusions about people based on their attributes like that. But I'm hoping that we can move beyond that to where we shouldn't just assume that, you know, the white male is going to have attitudes that were popular, you know, two generations ago, and allow for people to recognize we can move beyond those classic roles that have been troublesome, into realizing that anybody and everybody can really bring a value system forward that resonates with the majority of us. I'm looking forward, like Craig, you said, these four people who ran and now elected for school board are all judged on their merits and the policies they wanted to bring forward. I have high confidence. I think I have high confidence for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, we've seen some challenges the school district has been facing over the last several years that, you know, sort of emerged in this last session. I realize there were some people who stood into the school board who had to deal with those problems. I don't think the problems were of their making. I think the problems that they faced were inherited in some cases. But nonetheless, I think there's a heightened awareness of what some of the issues are that this school board will now have a chance to kind of readdress. And I'm looking forward to the work that they do.
And I'm wondering, speaking of that, I'm wondering, is our legislatures, both state and national, with the more influx of women, is that changing the way they're making decisions? Is that changing the way they're thinking and moving in ways of, what am I trying to say? You know, I mean, is that having an effect? And I think it is.
I would say it does. I wish I had an example to give you, but, you know, not only is it a gender shift, but it's also bringing in lived experience. So a person like Monica Dhingra, who has tremendous legal as well as behavioral and emotional health experience, you know, that may not have existed in the minds of our legislators before she was elected. And so I think we need to ask, not only is the gender bias changing, but what comes to the table as a consequence of that? And I do think that it makes for better decision making, in my personal opinion.
Well, I agree. Bruce, you had something?
Just quick. My sense is, I mean, you look at the House of Representatives, and you look at how divided it is, but you look at who is on the sort of a very progressive sort of left wing of the House of Representatives. And it's a lot of very strong women, our own representative, Jayapal, among them, and AOC, and there's a whole group of others. But you look at the other extreme, and there's also women on that sort of MAGA end of the spectrum as well, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greens. And so it becomes less gender to me.
And more life experience.
Sort of political. Right. But the fact that there are women representing those voices is what's significant to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys. Well, interesting show. I appreciate all of your efforts here to help me fill out my... my agenda. So have we determined a theme for next week, Kevin, or?
No, I think we have several folks who have not been able to arrange their schedules to join us next week. So it will be a repeat, I think, of topics of the day. But, you know, Creative Brieflies may find a solution.
I'm hoping that we'll be able to do the candy canes, but I'm not sure.
Oh, good. All right. Well, folks, for Kevin, Bruce, Craig, and me, thanks a lot for listening, and we hope you'll tune in next week. So we'll see you then.